throughout all of history, they've only talked about the fame, never the hard work, never the elbow grease, never the early call time.
Good morning, Earth. Early call time.
See,
I tried to do the Robin Williams thing again.
Yeah.
Didn't work out. But today,
next week,
we have a lovely friend on the couch.
We do.
His name is Hilaire Brosio.
Yes.
Did I pronounce it correctly?
Brosio.
Brosio?
Yeah. Okay. It works rolls.
I mean, we've known each other for a long time, and I think this is the first time I've ever introduced you first and last name.
Yeah.
So usually it's just fucking Hilaire.
Fucking guy. Hilaire and I used to work at NBC together on a show called LXTV's Open House, LA.
Mm-hmm.
Where?
40.
Yes.
Sorry.
Hilaire ran Steadicam. And what other cameras did you use for that? We used the underwater rig for that as well.
Right. We got the Gates housing with the EX1 for some pool shots. And was it waterfalls and stuff?
Yeah. Which we didn't get to use very much of, which is unfortunate.
Mm-hmm.
I loved editing that stuff. So thank you.
Fun.
Lots of bikinis.
No, nothing wrong with that. Something for everybody.
Yeah. Let's see. And then we've worked on a short film together. We worked on Andrew's short film a year or so ago, two ago.
The Heart.
So, Heart.
Right. And we did your piece too, The Carpool.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I forgot about that.
Oh, yeah.
We did some stuff for our old podcast too.
Yeah, he shot a lot of the red carpet events.
That's right.
Yeah.
So we've worked with Hilaire for a while now, and we thought we need to have Hilaire on the show because you have an interesting story in general, just in life in general.
Well, so it's been fun so far.
Yeah,
but it's also taken this long to get you on the couch because you're always somewhere else living. Yeah.
You are usually you travel more than most people do in their entire lifetime.
Well, we had a great run there for a while because my underwater camera work I do is in work as a producer, and my wife is a underwater and well, she's a photojournalist and she's a course director scuba diving. And so we were doing travel pieces for different travel bureaus and such around the world. So yeah, we were able to go to Antarctica and Sudan and the Bahamas and Indonesia and just name a few and shoot and Antarctica and South Africa are probably the tops. But yeah, for a while.
Yeah.
I think it was like 2011. We were like in Asia for a month and then we were in Antarctica for like 2-3 weeks. And then I figured out where else we went there. I think Egypt too. Yeah.
I'm fascinated with Antarctica. Where were you staying? Were you in the...
We went down... There was this company called Oceanwide Expeditions that had just retrofitted this massive icebreaker to start taking down groups of people. So it was like 114 people as their maiden voyage to the Drake's Passage out of Ushuaia, Argentina, the southern point. And that was wild. But, I mean, to get into Antarctica, you go through the Drake's Passage, they call it the tick of admission. We hit a Category 11 storm for 24 hours, 40 to 45-foot waves going over the front of the ship.
Whoa.
Out of 114 passengers, only like 10 of us were showing up for like breakfast and lunch. And even in
everybody else was sick.
Oh, they had all of the bulkheads closed, and you couldn't have coffee or anything to really drink in there either because we just go flying off.
Right. Yeah.
It was intense. But you know, that's where you're shooting this, going, this is so bitching. When I start editing, I'm like, we can't put that in their piece. You know,
right.
Come to Antarctica.
Right. Oh, yeah.
You'll be hurling for 24 hours, but the rest of the time it'll be great.
Right.
And you'll be nauseous from all the penguin poop that's everywhere. But no, Antarctica is great. But you know, it is kind of like who's that Herzog? Werner Herzog.
And
he's like, Antarctica, even your grandmother can go to Antarctica now. This does not the Lord once did. And it's like, yeah, it's true. There was a 94-year-old on our boat with his grandkids. But yeah, it's wild, but it's fascinating in that it's neutral territory.
Right.
There's some 40-50 science labs down there, though certain cultures are still killing whales and stuff down there, which they say is for research,
right?
Allegedly, it's a wild place. But I mean, it is just it's quiet as it gets.
Yeah,
and wildlife isn't scared of you. That's one of the wildest things. You know, these leopard seals will go grab a penguin when you're underwater, and they'll shake it like you would a banana, and just pull the skin right off, and then try to feed you.
What?
You know, they get right in your face trying to feed you a raw penguin. And same with
awesome.
Same with the penguins too. I mean, we'd go ashore to shoot and hang out and go hiking, and you're not supposed to touch them, mm-hmm. but they'll come right up to you and go right through your whole backpack while you're standing there. They'll come up and nuzzle you, you know. And the little the young ones are all kind of poofy still. You know? They like look like a big down pillow that's been turned inside out. But even humpback whales, we have to know why are they there to graze. I think came up next to the ship and just checking you out because. Wildlife doesn't have a fear of you because it doesn't have to yet.
Yeah.
And you, not only did you just shoot stuff on top of the land, you also were in the water.
We were diving, it was like 30-degree water. Oof. And my wife grew up diving in Budapest, which is frozen a lot. So she has some experience ice diving. But, man, it was rough. You got a dry suit on, you got 7mm gloves and stuff. And we had two awesome... dive guys on the boat, Kelvin Murray, fine schoolsman, and Heinrich is another one I just ran into recently too. Awesome, and they both worked with military and science expeditions, and they're both very well acquainted with both the Antarctica and the Arctic. Mm-hmm. And they were awesome, but we dove for a week down there, and that was intense. I mean, the first dive we went to a whale graveyard. This huge things of whale bones and such.
Yeah.
And down there, the kelp is like red instead of green. It's intense.
That's
and
cool.
Like, you know, but the sea lions and the oyster seals. No, clam seals, they call them, And penguins underwater, man, those are fun. They're like little rockets blowing around you. But, I mean, it was so cold. I mean, you get on there and your hands just hurt so bad.
Yeah,
and then they go numb. Then you can't even work the camera. So you get about 40 minutes.
Yeah.
But you need to get a huge respect for icebergs, too. Like, you look at an iceberg, usually only about 15 to 20% of it is above water. Mm-hmm. The rest of it's underneath. Oh. And it's extraordinary. I mean...
That's pretty cool.
But yeah, so we were down there shooting for a week. Then we put together a couple of videos, and you can find it on miss-scuba.com, my wife's site. But Oceanwide Expeditions, awesome. But yeah, there's a lot of companies that... Two operations like that now. National Geographic has one, and a few others. And but it was extraordinary because when my wife and I got married, we weren't married yet. We were trying to get married, and wanted to have a kid, and she was like, "I want to go to Antarctica." I'm like, "Okay, well, I want to go to Africa." I always wanted to go to Africa. I think my mom always wanted to go to Africa, and then she got married and had kids, and it worked out. It's kind of like. What's that movie? It's a Wonderful Life with Jimmy Stewart.
Mm-hmm.
Very beginning of it, he has this huge trunk, and he's packed, and he's going to go on this great world adventure. Mm-hmm. And suddenly his dad has a heart attack. He's got to take over the bank.
Yep.
Yeah. And I was like, no, we got to go to Africa before we decide to have a family, because we're not going to go otherwise.
Right, exactly.
Too expensive.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Whenever I tell people about the camera work and stuff that you do and swimming underwater and shooting all these beautiful things.
Yeah.
I tell them about Antarctica and how you said it was like swimming through plasma. It was so cold.
Yeah, it is. It is. And because, you know, water doesn't freeze, you know, it usually would. That's why it's 30 degrees or so, not frozen because it's salty.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, it was like going through like gelatin or something or plasma. It was a trip.
That would be amazing.
It was so wild. And like you have to have like two sets of regulators because sometimes your stuff will freeze.
Wow.
You know, if you take a breath on the surface of your rag, it'll freeze open. So you got to know how to turn off one side and turn on another. And, you know, it was bitching.
That's unreal.
Yeah.
What's it like doing all that and then having to operate a camera at the same time and getting the shots you want to get?
Well, it's lucky. I started diving in 1991, and so I dove for a lot of years before I started shooting underwater, and I started playing around when I got out of the music biz in like 2005, 2006. I started playing around, shooting underwater some, because I had a Sony HDV camera, Z1U, and a friend of mine had a housing for it. So I started doing volunteer for the Baykeeper and started shooting underwater. But since I've been diving so long, I had pretty good ability underwater to be neutral. You know, that's where you can go down like 100 feet and just hover right there.
Okay.
While you're breathing, you're not going up and down and stuff. And you learn some good, you know, kick techniques that you learn for like technical diving.
Mm-hmm.
It allows you to go into like ships and caves and knock down silt or stir it up, because sometimes if you stir up silt, it won't settle for a whole day sometimes.
Oh.
And you learn how to like kick backwards and stuff so you can get out of things. So I think, because I had a lot of thousands of hours diving, when I went to go run a camera underwater, it wasn't too bad because I knew how to run it on land already. But mm-hmm. it can be a lot. But that's where it's good. I have a course director wife, because sometimes right. Hilaire yeah. does get hung up on like shooting the sharks or her swimming with dolphins with a monofin, and Hilaire tends to maybe almost run out of air. Luckily, my wife, you know, I'll blow through a huge tank in 45 minutes sometimes, and she'll come up with 2/3 of a tank, you know, at the same time. So I know she has plenty of extra oxygen for me. But yeah, it's fun. But that's what kind of led me to doing Steadicam, because, you know, when you're underwater, you're like a jib, 100-foot jib on a gyro. You know, mm-hmm. you can mm-hmm. spiral down to something from 50 feet up and lock in on it.
Oh, that's cool.
You know,
yeah,
and
cool.
You can do anything. You're flying, basically. And they call Steadicam flying, but it's not, but it's as close as you're going to get to it.
Yeah.
You know, in some ways, there's other new things out now. But yeah, but shooting underwater, boy, it's just brought in a whole new world to me. And then, yeah, just out of the blue, the dive shop my wife was working out here, Aqua Adventures, got Greg, who runs it. Knows Mike Cameron, James Cameron's brother, pretty well. Mm. And they were working on the opening episode of season 2 of Dexter. Mm-hmm. I think that was in 2007.
I was going to bring this up.
Oh, yeah.
Actually. Yeah. And that was funny how that happened, because, yeah, Greg calls me up and he goes, yeah, I mean, Mike Cameron, James, you know, brother, we're going to be working on Dexter and we're going to use the Z1U. And Mike knows film. He doesn't know video. Could you come out to the pool with us and go over the camera with us? I was like, yeah, sure. And,
yeah,
you know, I had memorized all the, you know, frame rates and
right,
you know, MPS and everything with the stupid camera. I kind of showed them how to use it, and they're like, yeah, you know, live with this camera. What are you doing next Friday? You want to come down to Catalina with us? We're going to take a boat out, and man, just come along. And I was like, sure.
Yeah.
And then I get out in this boat, and this guy Wally Crowder is the head of the second unit. And it was funny, too. He's actually, well, that's another story. It goes back to Roadhouse. Everything's connected to Roadhouse for me. But he was the second unit director. And Tony Goldwyn was directing the episode, the guy who was in Ghost, who played the bad guy, you know, of the Metro-Goldwyn family.
Yeah,
you know?
Okay.
And he was directing it. Romeo Tyrone was the DP. And we got on a boat in Newport, went out to Catalina, and this is where divers discover all of Dexter's victims in body bags. And we're supposed to make it look like Florida, which is kind of tough because there's no kelp in Florida. But we anchor the boat, and we have all these huge trash bags, massive ones, that are filled with stuff the studio gave us to sink to make it look like body bags. And like they're like stuffed animals and stuff, which is hysterical, and is weighted down. And we're like, okay. And we take all this stuff down to about 40 feet or so, and we're on a really nice yacht, which we're using for the day, and some guy from Dive and Surf was there to consult. A lot of people were just kind of hanging out. And we're talking to Tony Goldwyn and Romeo Tyrone about the scene and how we're going to shoot it with these two divers and discovering the body bags, and they freak out, and a head and a hand pop out and, you know, the bag, and they go swimming off, freaking, screaming, or whatever. And they were talking about the scene, and they talked to Mike Cameron about how he would shoot it, and I talked to Greg some about how he'd shoot it, and they looked at me, and they said, what would you do? And I was like, well, I do this and that, and this and that, and this and that, and they all were quiet for a minute, and they said, well, why don't you just shoot it then? And I was like, okay. They're like, are you in the union? I'm like, no. They're like, are you in SAG? I'm like, no. They're all,
How are we going to do this?
And then Wally looked at me, and he said, you seem like a nice guy. I'm going to help you get in SAG. And I was like, okay. And we shot it, and Mike Cameron yelled at me a lot because he does that. He's a little crazy. He's a genius for sure. He came with a lot of that underwater stuff that James uses and has used in numerous movies. Mm-hmm. And he's created some great stuff with the Navy and stuff. But he's a creative genius, and genius is pain.
Right.
He reminds you of that.
Yeah.
but we shot it, and it was a blast. And then And then Wally kept his word after that. He started to hire me as an extra in Desperate Housewives. And he was working on that show, too, as well as Dexter. And he'd bring me to Dexter. He brought me to Dexter like 4 more times to shoot different underwater things or swimming pool scenes.
Yeah.
And he got me into SAG and AFTRA. And I get residual checks from all those.
Really?
I had to work on Monk with him once, too, for some underwater stunt work.
Huh.
And he was just one of those guys. He's like, you seem like a nice guy. we're going to take care of you.
That's awesome.
And oh, yeah, I need to give my wife plenty of work, too. She's worked numerous jobs with him, too, on different television shows and stuff. But, yeah, suddenly I was an underwater cinematographer, you know?
It's crazy. So what did you, well, I mean, what did you tell them that you were going to do differently than what they were saying to shoot that?
I think it's perspectives, you know? I mean, there's one thing I just learned early on just shooting stuff, you know? You don't move a camera, you move the dialogue or move the story.
Right.
So I think it was just kind of different angles and way we're trying to divide up the shots.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, you know, it was just, you know, you, at least I knew something about editing because I've been editing some four-wheeler shows for a while for the Outdoor Channel. And mm-hmm. I know you need as many perspectives and angles as you can get.
Yeah.
So it's like, you know, swimming backwards with the two divers coming at me.
Right.
You know, and, you know, hold your breath because you're going backwards, you're going to get bubbles in the frame. Oh. So a lot of holding breath, which you're not supposed to do when you're diving. And then over the shoulder as they're looking over things, and then the tight shots of the reaction and everything. And I just, I think what they were talking about, I was kind of just storyboarding out my head. So I said, well, let's do this, this, and this on one dive, and let's do this and this on another dive.
Yeah.
And we have to avoid the kelp because there's kelp down there on this side, so we can't shoot that way because you're going to have to get rid of that. And they're going to CGI in a bunch of stuff too, which when you see the final episode, you see this huge sort of like hole, like a crater, in, mm-hmm. in the ocean with tons of body bags. So they digitally enhanced it a lot. It looks much more cool than what we had. But I don't know. I just, because I was in one of those positions too where ignorance is bliss. So you got nothing to lose.
Yeah.
So right. These days, you know, if I go into a set very often, you don't tell people how to do their jobs, especially Tony Goldwyn or Romeo Tyrone or all that Crowder. You go, yes, sir. Yeah. And it is maybe not the best way to do it. You go, yes, sir, I'll get right on that, you know? So it's just, you know, naive enough to open my mouth. But, yeah, after that, I mean, I got to work with a number of the cast members, including James Raymar, who I'm a huge fan of, you know, ever since Warriors.
Yeah, oh, stuff. Yeah, that's
yeah.
right.
Oh, yeah, he's in the, in Long Riders, too. He's in.
I don't think I've seen
a bunch of man. He's Sex and the City, you know. But yeah. Walter Hill, he was a Walter Hill's go-to guy. It was a bad guy and tons of stuff. I think there's another one he's in with Walter Hill too. But the director puts him in everything.
Yeah,
and hence he had something to do with like, Sex and the City. So Raymar ended up on that too as Kim Cattrall's boyfriend. But he was a marvelous guy. The whole cast was really super, but fun time.
That's a great show, and. Again, I'm like, whenever I say, well, he also did some Dexter stuff, too.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Yeah, I got to work with Peter Dinklage briefly in one of the Dexter episodes, too. We're hiding in a racquetball court while they were shooting around us. But, nice guy. But, yeah. But
he
just,
was on
just
Dexter?
Fell into it. Pardon? Yeah.
Really?
Uh-huh.
Wow.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
I don't remember that.
I know. Maybe I imagined it, but I'm pretty sure it happened.
You briefly mentioned about your work in the music industry.
Yeah.
A lot of people, when we talk about their careers and where they came from, a lot of people, everybody's story is different. So editors, there's a few editors that were in finance and they decided, oh, I want to do storytelling and I want to learn how to be an editor. Mm-hmm. So they learn how to be an editor.
Right.
You had a career in the music industry.
Right.
That switched over and you started doing more video stuff.
Right.
What all did you do in the music? I mean, we talked about it briefly before the show, but they couldn't hear that.
Yeah. Okay. Well, I came out of college radio. I went to UC Irvine, and we had a 10-watt station, which I used to tell people is a 10,000 milliwatt station. And I somehow became music director there after a couple of years, which was great. And I was just, music was everything to me, especially in such an extraordinary music scene out here on the West Coast.
Right.
You know, punk rock is, you know, everything from the Adolescents to the Circle Jerks to the Dead Kennedys out of San Francisco is a great time. And it was fun to get into it because, you know, the world was basically just classic rock. Mm-hmm. And then came 91X and K-Rock and LIR on the East Coast. And things changed. But, yeah, I was in college radio, and then when I got an economics major, and it was like I could go to Wall Street or I could get in the music business. And when I was in college briefly, we shot a music video show called Alternative Video, which aired in Orange County and San Diego because we had all the contacts with the labels and managers and the bands, and everyone was kind of your buddies. I mean, the SST scene with the Minutemen, Husker Du, and Dead Kennedys – you know, always coming through town, drop by the station, or Social Distortion is right out of Orange County. I mean, it was just such a great community of people. We just, y'all knew, everybody sort of knew you. I'm very personable.
Yeah.
And, yeah, and then ran around the music business as a promotions marketing guy when I got out of college for like 16, 17 years. So I toured the bands. You know, back then, mm-hmm. radio was everything. Repetition is what sold music. It still does, repetition.
Yeah.
So radio would spearhead a charge, and then you might hopefully get some interest. You know, if it's a blue-collar rock band, maybe Vegas or Dallas. You know, there's some great markets out there for just blue-collar rock that you'd find in the Midwest and the East Coast. If it's an artsy little, you know, sort of artist, let's say like Sarah McLachlan, you're going after, you know, KCRW and coffee shops and stuff. Yeah, you get out there and try to find the single on the album, what a program is going to hammer. Something's decided for you. Sometimes you and I ask your programmer buddies. You have some thrown on at night. And then you pick a single and you go out and work it like crazy. And Tuesday was ad days with all the stations across the United States back when they were more independently owned before Clear Channel and everybody bought everything. And, you know, deregulation stepped in and killed everything. But yeah, there's hundreds of radio stations in the country. And I used to handle everything west of the Mississippi, so everything with a K in it.
Nice.
Wow. East of Mississippi is a W. And I did alternative for years, and I got to work at Big Time Records with like Levin Rockets when they were first launching the Earth, Sun, Moon album. And then Frontier Records, which was famous for the Sickle Jerks and Suicidal Tendencies. I think at the time we were working with Young Fresh Fellows. And then worked with Clive Davis, who people know from American Idol, as he signed some of those artists like Kelly Clarkson and stuff. And he ran Arista Records, and I worked there for about 8 years. And then moved on to Elektra with, you know, Motley Crue and AC/DC and stuff. So, yeah, you basically tour with the artists, get them on the morning shows, do the after show meet and greets, come up with interesting promotions, marketing ideas, you know, and then you're interfacing with retail, trying to figure out where they'd end cap it, where you're touring, try to get on a good tour, try to get as much visibility as you can, sell merch, because that's what's paying the band's bills, but that was their business back then.
Yeah.
Because that's the money they see first, if they see any money at all. And then with your, you know, premiere, your big acts like the Grateful Dead or Fish or something, you're just trying to maintain a blue chip stock.
Yeah.
And, you know, take them to Rockline, go talk to Bob Coburn. And you know, it was just a lot of babysitting, hand-holding, a lot of traveling.
Yeah.
But it was cool. I mean, at the time, you know, you'd be on the road with, let's say, Metallica, and it's like hanging out with a gang.
Yeah.
And when you come to town, everybody'd know you're there.
Yeah.
You know, and the gang's here, man. The party's here. And it was exciting. You know? And but yeah, you burn the candle at both ends in that world.
Sure.
Because I guess I was lucky because I had a pretty good talent of being able to stay up later than everybody and get up early and not be hungover and keep going.
Right.
And people loved Hilaire because you know, California's famous for green sticky weed. So
right.
I'd show up, probably I'd have pot. And that was a better path of taking because, you know, especially in the late 80s and the 90s, man, people are doing a lot of blow.
Mm.
And that was never my bag. And, you know, people usually want to get all coked out, go to your show, go spend a shit ton of money on dinner and go to strip joint and then do more blow. And my whole thing was
awesome.
Lots of blow.
It's fun for a while, but my thing was, is like, let's get stoned before dinner, and then you're going to be baked out of your mind, and we'll go to the show, and you probably just want to go home and go to sleep afterwards. And I can move on.
Exactly. Yeah.
So, but yeah, it was a fun time. But like I said, such a personable business back then. I mean, used to hang out with Steve Berlin all the time because he was producing a lot of our bands on Big Time Records, and he basically was adopted by Los Lobos and still tours with them to this day. So you know, we run into each other every now and then and talk about smoking hash at the Marriott and Times Square and something about how neither one of us really remember much because the most stoned we ever were, you know, and stuff like that. But it'd be fine. You trip into people, you know, and, you know, hanging out with Brian Johnson from AC/DC is never a bad time.
Yeah, I'm sure.
You know?
Well, I, when we had dinner a couple weeks ago, you were saying that you ran into him again shooting Jay Leno.
Stuff?
Yeah. Well, it was the same producer I did a lot of stuff with Jay Leno with.
Okay.
But yeah, it was a thing. This guy, Jeremy Hart, who owns this company, does a lot of auto stuff. We do a lot of stuff with Leno. Whenever a new car would come out, we shoot with him. But Jeremy was actually shooting something for the Rolls-Royce Phantom. And it's Brian Johnson's favorite car. Mm-hmm. And he's been on, what's that crazy car show?
Top Gear?
Yeah, he's been on that a few times, showing off and stuff. Yeah. And he loves the Phantom. But he races Porsches when he's not touring. And he was racing in Atlanta, Georgia in 2008, was it? 2010, yeah. Mm-hmm. And so we went down to go shoot him racing his Porsches. And people aren't supposed to know, I guess, though everyone does know, because a lot of liability on that guy in terms of insurance and stuff.
Yeah. Sure.
But it was great. But I'd worked with him on the Bonfire box set and then the Stiff Upper Lip release in like 2001.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And
I went on that tour.
Saw that tour.
A fun tour.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think Slash opened on a
chunk of Slash. Because I saw him in Vegas.
Right. I was there. Oh, Vegas was an amazing show.
Yeah.
Wow. That's crazy. and it was funny because here it is, you know, 7-8 years later. And we're in his room getting baked. And there's like, everything's all right, me son. Let me tell you a story, me son. Ah, it's a good one, me son. He's like, let's smoke a little, you know, all right, okay, now. And we're sitting there all baked. And we're with his manager and his wife. And I think another guy we're shooting with was in the room. And he looks at me through the smoke. And he goes, you know, I've only met one Hilaire before. Only one. And I go, yeah, that's me. I used to work at Electra Records. I was your West Coast rock tour guy. And I go, remember Stiff Upper Lip Tour? And I show him some pictures on the phone from like the Forum when they played the Forum that year and mm-hmm. stuff. And he's like, I guess, yeah, I've only met one. And he's like, what the fuck are you doing here doing this? You know? I thought you were doing that. And I'm like, well, that's all gone now. You know that. And he's like, well, good point.
Oh, that's awesome.
Oh, and he's a lovely guy.
Yeah.
He's 63 that year.
Wow.
And still just kicks ass.
Yeah, and they're touring right now.
They are.
We're seeing them in September.
Man, I think I might go. I'm so happy I saw the last couple of tours. The Black Eyes tour is amazing. It's sad Malcolm now, you know, is out. Yeah. But at least it's one of their nephews or something is playing. Mm-hmm. And Phil Rudd kind of screwed it up. But the old drummer who was an AC/DC cover band is back now, which is kind of funny.
Yeah.
So
sweet.
It worked well. But look, I think I was
did you see him at the Forum the last time at the Black?
Yes, I did.
That's the loudest show I've ever been to in my life.
I tell you, I went with a buddy of mine I've known in the bit, Todd Hensley, who is the president of Hits Magazine. I told him that was the best AC/DC tour since Fiddler's About to Rock.
Really?
The best. Probably the best. Cool. I mean, in terms of sound, production, staging, everything. Just unbelievable. But I think I heard an interview with, I think it was Keith Richards not too long ago. He said, you know what? AC/DC is the world's greatest blues band disguised as a heavy metal band. And he's right. I mean, you break it down.
Yeah, they really are.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. One of the funniest interviews I ever heard, this kid, little snot-nosed kid in New York, was interviewing Angus and Malcolm. And first,
I can already tell.
It starts out great, too. They're like, so do you guys like live in castles in Australia? And of course, Malcolm and Angus just thought that was hysterical. You know, just sitting there just smoking cigarettes, drinking their tea, because they both quit drinking about the same time Bon Scott passed.
Yeah.
So there's tea and cigarettes. And then the kid goes in this little snarky way about, so how do you feel that all your music is just based on three chords? And Angus looks at him, kind of smiles. He goes, that's a fucking lie. The kid goes, what do you mean it's a lie? He goes, all our music's based on two chords. You know? But those guys, they're pros, man. They clock in, clock out. They treat it like a job, mm-hmm. and they show up. And Brian still goes off and has a ball, and it sounds like Phil's been having a good time, too. But certain things you shouldn't do with prostitutes on your boat sometimes, threaten people's lives.
Yeah,
but do you know the guy whose life he threatened? Part reason he was threatening him is because he's blaming him for his solo album coming out and flopping.
Yeah.
Really?
It was his assistant, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Wow.
It's like, you know, you're not Dave Grohl or Don Henley. And never heard you sing before, maybe harmonies, but you know, probably do, don't you? Oh.
Yeah.
you got to hand it to AC/DC. And I think, but you know, look, hey, the fact they headlined Coachella this year.
Yeah.
Pretty damn cool.
Yeah.
Pretty damn cool.
Yep. And people that normally would have never went to an AC/DC concert got to see them.
Right.
Yeah. And now I bet you they're going to want to be there at Dodger Stadium in September.
I think so too. Well, you know, they were lucky because, you know, guitar, what was it? All the video games that were out for a while back.
Oh,
Guitar Player.
Guitar Hero.
Guitar Hero. Yeah, a lot of people discovered them for that.
Yeah.
You know, they were smart because like the Beatles, they held out to put their music on iTunes forever.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And when it came to people like sampling them,
mm-hmm.
They weren't tolerant of it.
Right.
You know, I remember the Beastie Boys had this one cut. It was on the flip side of Cookie Puss called Rock Hard, which sampled Back in Black. And when the BCs were putting out their best of retrospective, I remember they called Malcolm and they said, can we use it? He goes, no, it's one of our fucking biggest songs ever on one of the biggest selling rock albums ever. Why would we do that?
Right.
You know? And I think, because some people still say Back in Black's the biggest selling rock album ever. But overseas numbers are always questionable. But people put that at around 50 million copies.
Oh. Wow.
That's extraordinary, huh?
Are there even 50 million people?
Well, yeah. Actually, in Bonfire, you could get another copy of that as well. I believe they included it in that Bonfire set.
Wow. Well, they just keep remastering all the stuff, too. Because when the band moved from Elektra, because they weren't too happy with the way Sylvia Roan was running things, they went to Epic, and everything that had just been remastered was remastered again.
Oh,
you know,
I see.
It's kind of like, you know, like Evil Dead Part 2. How many more times can they put out another copy of it?
We brought up Evil Dead last episode.
Yeah. Well, you know.
Comes out.
Groovy. Evil Dead.
Yeah. Well, so we talked about a little bit about the music, but and then a little bit about the video. Right. How did you transition from one to the other?
Well, at least I had some roots in video, kind of, you know, some editing. It was very different back then for sure. And the cameras were really huge.
Yeah.
When the music business was kind of over, you know, I figured, you know, around 2001, it's like there's less and less labels. Mm-hmm. It's kind of like, you feel like when the party is over because the lights are on, you can see all the red cups in the corner and the passed out dude by the couch.
Right.
Yeah. You're like, it's time to go. This is done.
Yeah.
I was helping some buddies out doing some roofs and stuff. And then something came up about a four wheeler show. A friend of mine was hosting, this guy, Tony Becker, who used to be in Tour of Duty. It was a series on for a few years, and he was in the Waltons and he was in a bunch of movies. He was working on this four-wheeler show, and he says, yeah, we go out to Mojave. Where they? Now, he just came back from Moab, and he goes, oh, it's such a clusterfuck, and nobody knows what anyone's doing, and it's a mess. We got all these camera guys are all shooting the same thing, and I'm like, well, you need, like, a unit production manager or a field producer, which is kind of like what I used to do on tour. You got the clipboard, the headset on, and maybe, you know, minus the green sticky buds. And and I was like, you need something like that. And he's like, yeah. And they're going to be doing something up in Hollister, this Top Truck Challenge thing. And he goes, you should come and maybe quarterback this. And I was like, yeah, sure, sounds like fun. Big dumb trucks. Okay. Yeah. Right. You know?
Yeah.
Okay. And, but it was pretty wild. And then after we shot it, the producer was like, we need someone to edit this because we need DVDs and we need episodes for the Outdoor Channel. And I was like, I have a friend who edits, and funny enough, the guy I used to shoot the music video stuff with had a studio down in Venice Beach. So we started editing the stuff for Outdoor Channel and for their DVDs. And I, you know, kind of got my chops back then with Final Cut 7, which basically just started. Here you go. And, you know, you start just sifting and editing. And then I saw how bad some of the camera guys were. You know, they can't pull clean audio. They can't give me any composition or shot. They don't know how to pan or tilt. And, you know, so you get in and out of things quickly.
Yeah.
And so I bought a Z1U and started shooting it.
Oh.
And, I just started shooting because I have something to, you know, work with.
Yeah.
And I just started shooting tons of stuff. I have, you know, the Z1U, you know, you have a laptop Z1U. It's like DIY punk rock. Let's go.
Right.
Let's go have some fun. So, yeah. And then that morphed into doing underwater stuff, which turned into doing some Steadicam stuff later.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it was just kind of luck. But it's also like, wow, this sounds like fun.
Yeah.
I can do what I like to do. I can travel.
Right.
I can shoot. I can screw around, do some stupid stuff with cameras. All right.
Yeah. I've got a question that I've always wanted to ask you. Mm. How is it traveling with camera gear? It's got to be a nightmare, hasn't it?
It's fun, but it's a little crazy. I mean, you know, sometimes when we travel, like when we went to Antarctica, we had like probably 600 pounds worth of stuff between all our dive stuff and our dry suits and underwater housings, you know, and lights and all the other bells and whistles you need. So, I mean, it's nice to have status on the airline. That helps a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes it's good to, I just act like I don't speak English and I let my wife pull her Hungarian on people. And sometimes they just want to get rid of you and it's fine.
Oh, that's smart.
It's just, it's a lot of just shepherding and just praying stuff. Everything's going to show up. And we've only had, like, I had maybe a filter in one of my housings break once, and it was the one time they put the fragile sticker on the thing. I was like, no.
Yeah.
And of course, one time something breaks. It's crazy. I mean, it's exhausting, but you know, it's fun. I mean, you're on an adventure. You know,
no, of course.
It's living, but you know, it's not as bad. And look, I got a good buddy of mine does Amazing Race, and he's the Steadicam guy who travels with Phil. And, you know, that show, they travel for 3 weeks for that show. And what they do is just insane breakneck speed.
Yeah.
Because they have to stay at each destination until the last contestant shows up.
Okay. So
then they got to jump on a plane and get somewhere before the first person shows up.
That's crazy.
And they maybe get a hotel room a few times. And they just look forward to intercontinental flights because that's where you get a flight, sleep 14 hours finally.
Right.
You know, and you don't get all those breaks.
Think about that. Yeah.
So
can you imagine looking forward to that flight? Like, finally.
14 hours.
Exactly. And then Phil, man, he's up in the upper class, but he's up there putting on makeup, writing scripts, and it's nonstop.
Wow.
So, I mean, when I think about, I'm traveling, I'm tired, I think about Rob, and I go, I got it easy.
Yeah.
Just quit your moaning. Yeah.
Well, you got to use our show that we worked on, Open House, as kind of like a training guide in a way for Steadicam. Because I remember... Gosh, the first episode that we actually used the Steadicam, and it was just like, this is the way it should be.
That's so funny, too. That was kind of like me, the same way I learned the Final Cut 7, you just start.
Yeah.
And I remember, I'd worked with you guys for maybe a month or so.
Yeah.
And that's when my buddy Rob, Amazing Race Rob, said, you know, you should maybe try out Steadicam. Just get a cheap one. Don't spend $30,000.
Yeah.
You might hate it.
Yeah.
And I got a cheap one. But it was so funny. I had Brian Thomas, who was producer of the show then.
Mm-hmm.
So you got a Steadicam? I go, yeah, it just came. He goes, good. Let's use it tomorrow.
Yeah.
I haven't even taken out of the box yet.
Yeah.
But yeah, that was, well, you know, that show was so great. Some of my other cinematographer friends said, you're so lucky, because for a while we were shooting Monday through Thursday, and then it aired Saturday.
Yeah,
we didn't have to wait 3-4 months to see something. So
right.
It was so great for me to watch
what we used.
What you're using, what you weren't using, is I'm learning how not to fall in these really luxurious, expensive houses. I got to say, though, I counted my episodes. I'm close to 300 episodes.
Whoa.
I was like 281 when I left just recently, and I'll probably make it to 300 eventually. But out of all those episodes, I never screwed up a house. I was always waiting to knock over that Ming vase or put
right.
your arm through that stained glass window or something with the Steadicam on. But God forbid. But no, that was an awesome place. That was just instant feedback almost.
Yeah.
And that was a great time too, because since you're editing the show, it was just, I just love the fact we sit in the room sometimes, you and me and Brian, and just watch a show.
Yeah.
Say what worked, what didn't work. Let's try this more. Let's not do that. And it was great. It was more of a collaboration than most shows.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun.
At that time it was.
It was a lot of fun working with you and Brian and Jamie and all the whole crew. And
love Jamie.
Yeah. Yeah,
she's so much fun.
She's supposed to come visit soon. So
Let me know when she does.
Yeah.
She's one of her favorites.
Yeah, she was stern but fair.
Very, very well put.
Yeah.
And she keep it all in her place.
Yeah. I loved it. I loved working with her. I would always give her shit. But but no, it was really fun. And I learned how to talk to a camera guy because of you.
Yeah.
So thank you.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Hi, Hilaire.
Exactly. Weird guy with the vest on.
Yeah.
No, that was fun. Well, we had some great people, Ronnie and Joe Cho and Eric Wong and everybody. I mean, it's a great pack.
Yeah.
Can you talk a bit about the Steadicam and working with it? And I don't know, for people that maybe don't know what a Steadicam even is.
Sure.
What it is. And
The Steadicam was invented by Garrett Brown
Didn't you just recently meet him?
A couple. He's at the NAB every year, but every year I get to go hang out with Garrett and some of his other buddies. But Garrett was a cinematographer who was looking for a way to find a steady shot. And he went through some early ideas and locked himself in a hotel room at some point in the 70s and came up with the Steadicam. The Steadicam is a vest with an arm on it that's hinged in the middle. And what it works is kind of like, the best way to describe it is, you know, you're driving with a full cup of coffee in your car and you'll modulate your arm and you go over bumps and everything so you don't spill it.
Yeah.
Kind of the same thing as Steadicam is doing with the camera on the spring arm that's attached to you. And Garrett invented it and then went on to do a demo reel, which he was showing to people. And the demo reel, he shot his wife walking up the steps in Philadelphia. And the director who was going to do Rocky saw that and said, I want that camera and I'm going to use that shot. And they used a shot of Rocky running up the steps in Philadelphia, which was part of Garrett's demo reel. And then he did the movie on Woody Guthrie's life. Is it Homeward Bound? Southward Bound?
Homeward Bound sounds familiar.
That's, is that the one with the...
Isn't that the one with the animals?
That's the one with the animals. Yeah. It was, but the Woody Guthrie story. Actually, Tony Becker's in that too. Hal Ashby and Haskell Wexler did that movie together.
Oh.
And there's this famous shot where you see this car pull into a parking lot, and the camera's up on a crane. And as a car pulls in, the crane comes down to the ground. And Bear is on the platform of that crane with the Steadicam on. And suddenly, when it hit the ground, he walks off the crane around to the side of the car and follows the guy getting in the car. And that changed cinema for people.
Sure.
That was actually the first appearance of the Steadicam. And there's Rocky, and there's The Shining with the kid in the book, Big Wheel. It's Kubrick.
Oh, he's running with
it. And they had it on wheels for parts of it. But then going through the labyrinth of, you know, with Jack Nicholson, he handheld it. But that's where Garrett said he got really good at Steadicam because, you know, there's that one story of like him doing like 147 takes with Shelley Duvall till she was a mental wreck type thing. But so that's where Garrett got really good at Steadicam. But then it proliferated. But now later on, Garrett has invented the dive cam, the swim cam, the field cam. So like when you see the cable cams over football fields, basketball courts, that's him. Oh. The swim cameras you see the Olympics, underwater ones, that's him. The dive cams, that's him. The Moby cam, So Garrett's invented a lot of fascinating stuff. But it's a revolutionized film. Like when you watch Birdman, the Michael Keaton movie that came out this year, there's a couple of scenes in there, like 10, 15 minutes, uncut. Yeah. And that Steadicam guy was amazing. And remember the director, if you've heard anything about how they made that movie, it was just certain things, scenes would go 15, 20 minutes, nonstop. So if one actor screwed up something 12 minutes into a scene and someone in minute five gave the performance of their life, you were screwed. But
you see,
but that's a good way to watch Steadicam too, just where it's evolved to, where it's become sort of a part of the language now.
Right.
But now there's a lot of other things, like the Movi out there, and now you have drones that you can just fly in front of people too. But
What's the Movi exactly?
That's what Justin got.
Really?
He bought one.
Yeah,
but I don't know exactly.
It's like a carriage sort of with a gyro on it, and you can put a 10-15 camera, or 10-pound camera. They have bigger ones now, and it keeps it stabilized. So you can walk with it, you can spin with it, and it keeps it stable. Wow. Same idea the gyros work on, you know, the drones too.
Yeah,
right.
But it's kind of hard to hold something 10 pounds.
Yeah.
For so long.
Yeah.
It's like trying to hold a couple full steins of beer. It sounds easy until you do it for 3-4 minutes and try to not shake.
Right.
But it's just another great tool out there. But Steadicam, it's really, I know you see it in football all the time too, soccer.
Yeah,
those things. That's hard. That's where you're wearing it for. Concerts are worse too.
Yeah,
because you're wearing it for like 3 hours, not taking it off. You know, but pays the bills.
Oh yeah. And like a lot of live events are like award shows. They do it on award shows too.
Yeah, absolutely, You know, on the red carpets and everything. So. It's a great craft to learn because it's what I love biomechanics. You know, I was big into skydiving for a number of years. Scuba diving's another thing where you have these great pieces, mountain biking, any biomechanics, it's the human body and what you can do with it when you have some cool gear.
Gadgets,
That's definitely, it was right down my alley.
Yeah.
And, my buddy Rob, who got me into it, I mountain bike and ski with him and stuff, or he skis circles around me, but he's into it too, so we're both kind of cut from the same cloth.
That's great. I'll
never be as good as him.
Yeah.
Never. What do you do?
Let's see. Well, do you have any advice for anybody out there that wants to be in your profession, either segment producing or being a Steadicam operator or anything?
Sure,
along those
lines. I think
music exec.
Well, fake it till you make it.
Yeah.
Number one, get in and if someone asks you, do you know how to do this? Say yes, and then get on the phone and on the internet fast as you can. And call some friends, and look up Google some videos on YouTube. I think you got to go. You just got to start working, and maybe you don't get paid at first.
Mm-hmm.
And you got to remember that. I mean, so many people in the entertainment business have those day jobs. Like even Philip Glass was driving cabs when he was composing things, and he was known already. But you got to pay bills. So I think, just start somewhere. I mean, like when I was in the music biz, everyone's sitting in their offices when you were in the office, and usually you'd be watching ESPN or they'd be watching the stock market, mm-hmm. or Mexican soap operas, because they're just fun to watch for a number of reasons. But I was always watching like underwater videos, mountain climb videos, mountain bike videos. And I would think at the time I was like, I want to do this. And it wasn't so much just want to mount, I wanted to make that. So yeah. I just started to deconstruct it. So I guess that kind of Quentin Tarantino school of just educate yourself. You know, Abraham Lincoln, read a book every day. You know, same Tarantino, watch movies. What school did he go to? He watches movies.
Yeah.
You know, so yeah, I mean, dissect what you want to do, take it apart, figure it out, and just, but go work. If you have to go work for free, go work for free. And go work for people, if you can, who you respect. Because that's who you're going to learn from. Because we've all worked for people we don't respect. You don't learn anything then.
Nope.
And then ask a shit ton of questions. Because I was taught early on, you know, it's easier to ask a stupid question than fix a stupid mistake. Mm. And sometimes you ask questions, people see that you're tuning in too, you know? Like you're thinking, you're not just showing up. Because I see so many people who just, they're there, but they're like 90% there, if you know what I mean. You know, they're more occupied with their phone or something stupid. Yeah, I guess that's it. Just try.
Mm-hmm.
You know, try. I think so many people just
apply yourself.
Yeah, wait for the phone to ring. Yeah. And just, you know, it's like we used to say when skydiving days, we'd say, pussies can't be heroes. So, gotta get off the couch, you know, do something.
Yeah, it's very true.
You know, good things come to those who stay busy while they wait.
Yeah.
You know?
Oh, that's true.
So, it's been fun. I think my dad said to me once, he goes, most people go to college and get a law degree or become an accountant. He goes, you just do what you want to do. And I'm looking at him, I'm like, that's what you're supposed to do. You just follow your hobbies. And I'm like, okay, tell me what's bad about all that.
You know? Yeah, exactly. So, as long as you're happy, I feel like do what you want to do.
Well, all of us, you guys are on the creative arts too.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, and there's a lot of, I think there's so often too, like when I first did that first Dexter thing in 2007, I was like, all right, I've made it. I'm there. And then nothing happens. And
you're
like, oh, well, I did that.
Yeah.
And I have to go do something else.
Right. You know? Just keep having those moments, you know, it's kind of like that.
Yeah. But I think you got to get off the couch, get out and circulate, you know, I think just work begets work too. And there's a lot of jobs I've taken, which I've hated, but they've led to awesome things.
Right.
And sometimes you just meet somebody and they remember you and they call you back.
Yep.
You know, and I worked on a Bob Clark documentary with a good friend of mine, Darren Abrams. He's a guy who did Porky's and The Christmas Story and stuff. And, I was working for nothing for him because it was just fun. And we're interviewing some fascinating people too along the ways, like John Voight and stuff. I worked with Bob Clark. But it was a couple years later, Darren thought of me and he was shooting this makeup thing for this French company, Votre Vue. And he called up out of the blue and says, hey, I'm going to go to Paris for 4 or 5 days. I was like, hell yeah. Because I can pay you this time too. I mean, really pay you. You know, so, you know, but yeah, sometimes you got to eat some crow for a while. But
yeah.
I don't know. I think just if you have a craft you like, you're going to work at it. You're going to practice. You're going to eat, drink, and sleep it.
Yeah.
And it's so easy to research things these days. When I was a kid, you had to go to the library and go through card files.
Yeah. What's a card catalog?
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. My kid will never know.
Nope.
So my dad, I joke because we just built this huge bookcase because I have tons of books and tons of comics. And I know when my kid grows up, he's going to look at me and go, Dad, you must really hate trees. Why? You just get all this online. I'd be like, yeah, I guess I must hate trees.
Yeah.
Oh, all right.
You know? In all the, I mean, you've been to a bunch of different places and shot all kinds of different stuff. Is there anything that stands out? We do a horror story segment if people have had things that have gone horribly wrong. Is there anything
like a grip trap going off a cliff?
Yeah. anything where something's just gone horribly awry? You don't have to name names or productions, or it could be something you witnessed.
No, I've been pretty lucky. I'm trying to run through my head here. I've been in times you wonder why someone hasn't gotten killed. Because they do say, Dan Neese said this, who's a famous cinematographer, he goes, if you're doing a shot that almost kills you, it's probably going to be one of the best shots of your life. You know. But
that's true.
Very good sense. Yeah.
But I definitely done some stupid stuff. I'm trying to think what's more interesting stupid than just stupid. I think it was one of the first times I was shooting with my wife. We're down in the Bahamas. and we're shooting this dolphin experience.
Oh, you edited
it
for us.
You know it well.
Yep.
So they have these dolphins at UNEXO down there, and they have like 20 of them or something. But what you get to do is you get to go out into the open ocean with a couple of them and go swimming with them. My wife had this really great monofin that she used to do technical orienteering diving with. And she moves with this thing. And she's monofin on. She's hanging on this dolphin side. And they're hauling ass around the ocean. And I've got my EX1 of the big old housing and everything. And I'm swimming backwards trying to keep up with them to get shots. And everything was going great. Until I went, and there was no air.
Oh, shit.
We're down about 30, 40 feet, probably 40 feet. And luckily, we have that unspoken language where she just had to look at me. And I'm looking at her going, and I'm like, fuck. And she swam over and was fine. You know, she gave me her alternate, went to the surface. And the guy who was running the dive was like, that's the stupidest thing I ever heard of. How could you do that? And he's not professional. And I was like, all right, but I'm thinking to myself, but I got the shot.
Yeah.
I got the shot. Yes, I do. So that was one of those things. I haven't run out like that
again. Yeah.
I mean, you come close sometimes if you're doing something. And, you know, fortunately, when we do a lot of our shooting, we're not down there. We don't have a luxury of time.
Mm-hmm.
You're going to get one or two dives to go shoot a wreck.
Yeah.
Or go shoot the sharks or the mantas or something or the cave.
Right.
So, I mean, you really...
The cave stuff was amazing.
Yeah, well, it was fun down there. With Christine Zanotto, but I guess, you know, from that, there's that Mark Twain saying that good judgment comes from experience, and experience comes from bad judgment.
Yeah.
So, got to learn from that stuff.
Or
you won't be diving much longer.
Right.
You know?
Right.
Yeah.
That much like our horror story segment is, that's kind of, we want to be able to say, well, these are the mistakes that we've seen.
Mm-hmm.
Don't do this.
Yeah.
So that, you know, I feel like I've learned from other, more than my fair share of, I'm learning from other people's mistakes and knowing that I shouldn't do that.
Yeah.
And
have oxygen.
Yes, have oxygen.
Have oxygen. And I think rushing always kills you.
Yeah.
Especially in anything, like when you're shooting stuff and you're moving around, moving vehicles or wild animals or anything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've done stories of Steadicam guys trying to get that very last shot of the day, and they're exhausted, and they walk backwards into the pool with all the gear in. You know, and suddenly, you know, the camera's dust.
Right.
And Steadicam, hopefully not dust, monitor maybe.
Yeah.
And you're trying to see if you can get the taper or the disc out of the camera as fast as you can, because you're going to lose the whole day's shoot.
Yeah.
Too. So, yeah, it's just, but rushing, man, that always screws you.
Yeah.
For sure.
Patience is a virtue.
There you go.
It is.
Right. Yeah. And no brain, no pain.
Yeah.
Helps.
That's true too.
Yeah. I'm working. That's all the one-liners I got. I'm done.
Well, thanks for being on the show. This has been fun.
Totally. It was a blast. Thanks for having me in.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you can, do you have a Twitter account or a Facebook account that people can contact you?
No, I tell you, look at my wife's site, because a lot of our cool dive stuff, and she does some extraordinary things. She's working on Agent Shield Monday, doing some water work, but it's miss-scuba.com. And
all those videos that we cut,
you got
are
on
there.
You cut, yep, you got it. Yeah, our shark and our dolphin and our cave and our wreck and everything.
Yeah.
And that was the beginnings of Miss Scuba for us too. So
nice.
You were there on ground zero with us.
Yeah, those are fun. Those were so much fun.
Yeah,
especially with the dolphins and like having them spin you around and stuff.
Oh, it was great. Really cool. And then give you a little kiss. And stuff. You know?
Yeah.
Luckily, that's all they did, because dolphins can get frisky.
Oh, I had no idea.
Another horror story.
There are stories. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that's another podcast.
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
And well, you guys can follow us on our Twitter account.
Really Call Time.
Yep. And Andrew, you're at.
I'm at the Real Zuber.
I'm at JJ Geiger 7-Eleven. Nadav is at the
Very Nadav Show.
Yes.
Or Very Nadav Show.
Yeah.
Something
like that.
Like that.
Yeah. And you, and anyway, thanks again for listening. And
you should go on ahead and listen to the outro.
And that's a wrap. Didn't get your fill at Craft Services and you want more? Check out earlycalltime.com for more podcasts and information pertaining to the ever-growing entertainment industry. And remember to tell your friends about us via Facebook and Twitter. Thanks for listening.